Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and yes, as regular listeners would know, the show is just running the news and sponsor segments at the moment. There are no feature interviews for the time being, but that's fine because we've got plenty to get through in this week's news segment with Adam Boileau coming up in just a moment. And then we've got a killer sponsor interview for you this week with Nick Steele and James Barclay of Duo Security. They're here to talk about WebAuthn. It is the new authentication spec currently going through the W3C process. Both Nick and James will be along a little bit later on to talk about what the spec is designed to do, how it works, and what its chances of becoming mainstream are. And spoiler alert, those chances are looking pretty good. They've also provided me with some links for people out there who want to play around with WebAuthn. And, you know, honestly, this stuff really does look to be the future of auth over the internet. It won't be too long before you'll do a fingerprint or face scan on your mobile device to authenticate desktop browser sessions to lots and lots of services and sites. It's very cool stuff. Big thanks to Duo Security for being this week's Risky Business sponsor and also for providing us with such an excellent interview this week. I let that one run along. But of course, before all of that, we're going to get into this week's news now with Adam Boileau. And Adam, pretty decent week for news, actually. Definitely some lulls in here. And the biggest lull, the prime lull of the week is last week we reported on a couple of these Cisco bugs that were, you know, real horror shows like CVSS 9.8. And people have been having all sorts of fun with them over the last few days.
Yeah, the one that's been getting coverage this week is this bug in the Cisco, like, switch self-configuration, auto-configuration thing for when you deploy a new switch called the Cisco Smart Install thing. Apparently, it's on by default, which I didn't realize, in Cisco Catalyst switches, and it lets you kind of, you know, configure them. You can TFTP new configs through them and upgrade their firmware and that kind of thing. Anyway, apparently, people realize this and have been scanning Shodan or using Shodan's data about scanning for it and owning up all sorts of Cisco iOS, you know, and iOS XE routers and switches on the internet for all sorts of various reasons, it turns out. But yeah, Cisco, for their part, have said basically, this is not a bug. This is kind of a feature which maybe you should, I don't know, pack a filter at the edge of the network so you don't
You shouldn't. Maybe you shouldn't ship on by default. Another way to look at it, you know.
Well, exactly, yes. But yes, yeah, so a couple of 100,000 people apparently were running this internet facing according to Shodan, and a bunch of them had a really bad day, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we just advise all of Cisco's clients to just log into your device using the username Cisco and password Cisco, and you'll be able to fix it that way.
Yes, so true.
Oh, so, you know, don't worry if you've forgotten the passwords. They've helpfully set up some easy-to-use credentials for you. But, yeah, some of the data centers and, you know, various telcos getting owned by this stuff, they've had, like, ASCII American flags dropped on them in, on Russian boxes and Iranian boxes saying, you know, don't mess with our elections and stuff like that. Like real sort of silly skiddy stuff that's been written up in Motherboard.
Yeah, apparently some group that was doing that owned a whole bunch of them and were, as you said, defacing ones in Russia and Iran and places like that, and were apparently patching or at least turning off this feature on American ones. So good old-fashioned, American vigilante mob storming its way around the Cisco's of the internet. Yeehaw.
Yeehaw. And CyberScoop has a fairly interesting sort of mini feature here, which is arguing that as, this trade argy-bargy kicks on between the United States and China, we could see Chinese APT crews coming back to do more IP theft against Five Eyes targets after that, that agreement was signed and it sort of dropped off for a while. So this piece is sort of arguing that might start happening again. Little too early to tell what the risk of that is, especially when Xi Jinping just came out and did a very sort of pro-free trade speech just hours ago. So, yeah, hard to know what's going to happen here, but it is, it's a what-if piece, but reading it, I did really think, yeah, this is raising some good points. Things could get – we could go back to the bad old days.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's unrealistic to imagine that these things operate in isolation, right? I mean, the Chinese have always been – interested in kind of competing in a holistic manner, and protecting the national interest and advancing the national interest in a holistic manner. And obviously, the cybers have been a tool they've used in the past, and there's, good reason to expect that in a more hostile world that they would use it again, much as, as other countries also are kind of, asserting their rights to be able to do these kinds of things in their national interest. So, yeah, I don't think it's unrealistic. And certainly if you're in an industry that would be a target of this kind of thing, then, you know, this is probably your chance to, you know, get ahead of what may end up happening, you know, if we do start seeing an uptick.
Yeah. Also, recently we reported on the passage of the Cloud Act in the United States, and a big part of that is going to be MLAT reform. And I did mention that, you know, certainly the Australian government and Australian law enforcement agencies would be quite excited by the passage of that bill. And apparently we've already got a plane load of representatives like flying to America right now to become one of the countries that can do a deal with the US so that we can access... so that Australian courts can issue warrants to allow access to data on Australians that is held in America. So, yeah, it looks like the Australian government is just itching to get on that list.
Yeah, which I guess, you know, is understandable for all the reasons that we've talked about in the past on the show. And, I mean, this kind of reform is – I mean, what's the alternative, right, other than them making this a process that actually works for law enforcement in places like Australia? You know, obviously you're not going to see this extended to countries that don't have – you know, at least some degree of reasonable protection in their legal systems. But, you know, for Australia and the UK, yeah, maybe this is a thing that will actually happen.
Oh, now a story getting a lot of traction for reasons that aren't entirely clear to me is the Department of Homeland Security in the United States has put out like, you know, they're soliciting proposals for their media monitoring, you know, services, which, you know, really standard run-of-the-mill PR media and sentiment monitoring, which is something that the PR industry has been doing since basically its inception. It's part of, you know, it's a big part of the PR industry. And people have lost it. They're saying, oh my God, they're trying to monitor journalists and what they think, and this is one step before they round them all up and put them in the gulag.
Yeah, I think this is what happens when, you know, for most people, how technology works and how privacy works and how, you know, all of this stuff ties together is really just magic spooky fingers, you know, and you don't have any idea what is, you know, how it all fits together. And so, yeah, you end up kind of railing against, as you say, what is ultimately just normal operation of the PR industry rather than other things which are actually relevant. So, yeah, it's, you know, you can see why people are kind of twitchy about privacy, but you're right, this is just the wrong thing to get worked up over.
Now, China has taken a pretty blunt force approach to getting some visibility on its Uyghur population, and they're forcing residents in certain areas to install surveillance apps onto their phone. Like, that's it, you have to use this app.
Yeah, apparently they've been sending out like WeChat messages saying you must download and install this app called Jingwang, which monitors your device for like controlled content. So it will has a bunch of hashes for, you know, sort of subversive content or documents or images and things, presumably targeting the Uyghur minority and, you know, some of the protests and movements that they've had against the Chinese central government. Anyway, so they've been monitoring the people on their phones, which, if that wasn't bad enough, this particular app also will then kind of report in content it finds to some centralized system and does so, like, in the clear without preserving any privacy and without any kind of repudiation. So presumably you can kind of inject other, you know, fake content from other people's phones being submitted to the system, and it all just – it's, you know, Orwellian, you know, cyber oppression at its – you know, sort of dystopic worst.
So how can they force people to run this? Does it send like out some sort of beaconing, and if you don't have the app, the beaconing stops and they boot you off the network? Like, how does this work?
So that bit's not entirely clear. You know, the only reporting that we've got so far says that, you know, people are told to install it, but I don't know what kind of, you know, whether there's some carrier side mechanism where they can, you know, force it to be there or otherwise restricted. So yeah, that we don't really know.
Hmm. Akamai's put out a bunch of research on IoT, and it makes for pretty depressing reading.
Yep, they've put out a report looking into the use of UPnP control proxy abuse on IoT, which is kind of, as you know, IoT vulnerabilities go, it's kind of one of the old, you know, sort of heritage vulnerabilities rather than something new and modern and hip. But it is a thing that is apparently in active use by a bunch of groups. So through Universal Plug and Play, you can kind of configure a router at someone's house to set up port forwarding, which of course you can use to get onto their internal network. network if you wanted to, but you can also use it for connecting onwards to other systems on the internet, so as a proxy. So they've been monitoring devices and have determined that people are actually using botnets of UPnP devices as kind of anonymous, you know, little private Tor network sorts of things.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. It's like a do it. It's like old school movie hacking. Like, it's bounced off 10 routers in 5 countries, you know?
Yes, exactly. But it's just, I mean, it's kind of funny because it's one of the kind of oldest sets of things that have been wrong with IoT devices, as opposed to, you know, default credentials or actual bugs, you know, that have been getting, you know, more fame recently. But yeah, the fact that all of the stuff is still out there and still being owned in all of the old ways as well as all of the new ways, I think is, I mean, it's not really a revelation, I guess, but, you know, it's the way things are.
DARPA is spending a bit of money to take a look at hardware security tools. You know, I think the headline says it's about looking to avoid another Meltdown or Spectre, but I think it's a little broader than that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously this research into, you know, hardware vulnerabilities or vulnerabilities that involve interaction between, you know, microcode and low-level firmware and, you know, hardware systems, you know, is new and interesting and quite an expensive, relatively, I guess, area of research. It's the sort of thing that DARPA's funding, you know, has historically been quite good at dealing with, you know, those, you know, really complicated sets of research. So, you know, be interesting to see what this turns up.
Yeah, they've contracted a company called Tortuga Logic to do that. So best of luck to you at Tortuga. Oh, here we go. This is an interesting idea. Some developers figured out that they can use zero-width characters to watermark documents. So if people start, you know, cutting and pasting them, like, they can get caught. That's an interesting idea. Very sneaky.
Yeah, it's a fun trick. I mean, this kind of, you know, embedding secret marks in documents to track who's leaking them, I guess, is a thing that's been used a bunch over time. But yeah, doing it with Unicode non-printable characters that then survives copy-pasting, like, that's, I think, is pretty cool. And you can certainly see some interesting uses for that when you're worried about who is, you know, who's leaking stuff. I think in this particular case, the guy came up with it because he wanted to spot who was leaking stuff out of, like, their online, like, Overwatch crew or something, you know, whatever online gaming thing they were playing, so that people wouldn't give away their secret tactics to whoever else was, you know, reading their chat. So that's kind of funny.
It is, but I mean, you know, like, copy-paste into 7-bit ASCII kind of gets around this, right?
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously, if you can down-convert it or, you know, paste it into something that can spot, like, once you know about a covert channel like this or a steganographic technique like this, then, of course, you can avoid it. But, yeah, the trick is not telling people, which, oops, I guess we ruined that.
A lot of people getting angry at T-Mobile on the internet and being very mean to some, like, lowly customer support person on Twitter. But, yeah, T-Mobile Austria was saying, oh, you know, we store your passwords in plain text, but don't worry because our security is amazing. And it's like, and there was a huge pylon, which I didn't think was really fair to the poor person copying the abuse, to be honest.
Yeah, it was a good example of InfoSec Twitter being really quite mean to someone who probably didn't really deserve the full fury of hackers spurned. But yeah, obviously, you know, storing clear text creds is not a great idea. Obviously, all the telcos also do it, but hey, you know, let's just let them be telcos. And yeah, I feel sorry for the poor Twitter CSRs.
Oh, here's one from Bleeping Computer that's just like a WTF kind of story, which is if you search for Chrome download using Bing, you're going to wind up downloading something else. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, apparently the ads for Google Chrome downloads on Bing were serving like a malware or at least like a package with extra toolbars and search assistants or whatever. Version of Chrome. Which,
the special,
you know,
version.
The special version. I mean, to Microsoft's credit, they pulled the ad within 24 hours of it being reported. But, like, what year is it that this is a thing where it's not safe to search for software downloads through a major search engine? I mean, it's not like this is Tucows or CNET or something.
Oh, now here's an interesting one, Adam. Three people are now in prison for pirating Oracle firmware patches, which is it's interesting, right? Like, actually in the slammer.
Apparently, yeah, these guys ran a company that did, you know, IT support or systems maintenance for a bunch of customers, and they had signed up to Oracle.com with fake accounts and then downloaded, like, Solaris patches and stuff and then given them to their customers, presumably as part of a, you know, support arrangement, without actually having a support agreement with Oracle for their individual customers. Oracle alleged, I guess, successfully, given that they're going to jail, you know, what, like $80 million worth of damages or something for pirating software patches. And yeah, they're off to the clink, which, I mean, on the one hand, like, clearly they were pretty shady businessmen if that's what they were doing. On the other hand, who hasn't made a fake Oracle.com account, you know, like, larry@mailinator.com to download like Java SDK, JDK packages from the dawn of time that you need for something that you can't get without logging in. Like, I don't want to go to jail for that. That seems ridiculous.
Yeah, but they're bypassing, I mean, I think the thing is here, they're bypassing the actual requirement for support contracts and stuff, and that's, well, you know, that's maybe the issue, right?
I guess we can give Oracle's lawyers that one. Suppose.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Oracle's lawyers didn't put him in jail. The US government did, so there's that. Now, things are actually heating up between the Russian government and Telegram, because Telegram has just point blank refused to hand over, you know, various keys to the Russian government. It looks like they're going to get banned in Russia because they're refusing to play ball, which is interesting.
Yep. Turns out the Russia's telecommunications watchdog has started filing the necessary procedures to get it actually put on the list for being banned in Russia. So, yeah, that may be the beginning of the end for Telegram inside Russia.
It'll be interesting to see how that plays out politically, right? Because I remember just being in Brazil when WhatsApp goes down, and it's never popular when the government takes your toys away. So, and there's a lot of users in Russia. So let's see if anyone blinks on that. VirusTotal has released its Android sandbox, so you can now. Well, is it a sandbox or an emulator? What would you call it?
Well, this is the sandbox for processing Android applications through VirusTotal. They had a previous version that they released a few years ago now, 2013. And this is the updated version that allows you to upload APKs, have them be run in the emulator, and kind of figure out what it is that they do. So I guess it is both a sandbox and an emulator, a sandboxed emulator.
There you go. No wonder I was confused. So yeah, that one's called Droidy. Disclosure, VirusTotal are a risky business sponsor, but you know, I'm sure there's some people out there who will be interested in that, because I'm sure you've got some shady APKs to throw at it, because they ain't exactly that hard to find. Now I found this very interesting. Someone managed to hijack like 2,000 subdomains that were misconfigured using Amazon CloudFront. They were like abandoned domains, and they were able to get a hold of them, and they would have been very useful for various nefarious purposes. What did you think of this, Adam? How did they actually do this?
So in the Amazon like CloudFront thing, which is CloudFront's the front end like CDN proxy thing for Amazon. So you can specify for a particular domain name, you're going to serve up this content out of your particular S3 bucket. Now you have to tell the CloudFront system what domain names you're going to be serving content for. And if you don't list them all, so if you've got, say, entries in your DNS, which you don't then have a corresponding entry in the CloudFront configuration, somebody else can come along and add themselves a CloudFront account that uses a name that's in your DNS but isn't in your CloudFront configuration, and then hijack incoming requests. So a user that comes in across a CNAME in your target's DNS then gets served content by CloudFront off the attacker's systems rather than...
So no need to prove you're the owner of the domain, basically. You can just hijacking. Yeah, got it.
Yeah, there's no binding between the CloudFront configuration and the DNS. And so, yeah, this is a situation where the DNS doesn't match because the person who configured it didn't necessarily add all of the names. And yeah, somebody went through, created the proof of concept, they registered a bunch of these, and then eventually told Amazon about it. Amazon, I think, have now taken ownership of all of those CloudFront configurations and made it go away. And they've added some things to the control panel that will warn you when you're configuring these things, much as they've done for OpenS3 buckets and other things. But yeah, it's a really good example of the complexity of Amazon services. Like every time you log in, they've added some new feature that you don't know what it does, and all of them have security implications for you. So yeah, it's this is what happens.
Well, and there's regular like CDN voodoo as well. Like they're very, fiddly things, aren't they?
Well, they are, right? I mean, I had to read the description of this particular issue like 5 times to understand exactly what was going on. So, yeah, it's super fiddly.
Yeah, and Commonwealth Bank of Australia was one of those named that had a domain, a subdomain.
Yeesh.
Yeah, so, and I know they listen, so yeesh.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Hi. Oh, now we've got our comedy bug of the week, and it's courtesy of Microsoft and Windows Defender. And this is according to Tavis Ormandy, he wrote that basically Microsoft used the open source UNRWA code, but then changed all the signed integers to unsigned for some reason and broke the code. It was Halvar, I think, who actually found this one. He noticed it and got it fixed, but it was remote system memory corruption on a scan. And it's just like, wow, that's bad.
Yeah, it really is bad. Because obviously bugs in antivirus are great because getting content in front of an antivirus scanner is super easy, right? I mean, that's because, I mean, by design, an antivirus scanner is supposed to catch every way that you can talk into the system. So just, you know, emailing a file or getting it onto disk or going past anywhere where the scanning engine will consume it is enough to trigger these bugs. And yeah, this one in the RAR parser was particularly boneheaded.
But I mean, would exactly the RAR parser kind of even work? Like, did they do anything to make it work after they changed, like, signed to unsigned? That shouldn't work, right? Presumably
they tested it, and depending on, you know, what the variables in question are used for, it might not matter. You know, if it's like file offsets or something, then obviously making it from signed to unsigned, you're never going to seek negative in the file, so it probably would still work. But if it's, you know, other sorts of things, then clearly it can go a little bit more wrong.
It's sort of, I think my favorite bug of all time was probably, well, one of my favorites. There are so many, but one of my favorites was the Apple Spotlight bug. Which, you know, I mean, that thing is like, you know, just indexes all of the content on your disk. And there was a bug in the PDF parser. This is years ago. So all you had to do was get a file onto the disk and it would, like, eventually get around, scan it, and pop your shells. So that's quite nice.
Love bugs like that. So good.
they are good. They are good. Also, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute has published a document on Australia's offensive cyber, you know, cybers, which is kind of interesting because, and the only reason I'm talking about it is because most governments don't really talk about the offensive side that much. So it's nice to see some documents coming out that really discuss it.
Yeah, and it is really useful to see this being, you know, kind of discussed clearly in the open. And I mean, I think there's an important distinction made between, you know, civilian, you know, criminal use and military purposed use of the same techniques, which is, I think, is a distinction that is often lost when people are talking about it. So that was good to see articulated. The other side of this piece, of course, is as many of the Twitterati, InfoSec Twitterati, have pointed out, had its impact somewhat lowered by the presence of Norse map pew pew GIFs in it.
Yes.
Which, yeah, does detract a little bit.
Yeah, and this is by the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, which was a government, the Australian government established ASPI, and it is, you know, partially government funded, I think majority government funded actually, so designed to be a, you know, non-partisan defensive think tank. So definitely something that's been published with the government's cooperation and go ahead. And finally, Adam, our skateboarding dog this week is Rudy Giuliani, who has shown up in a commercial. He's trying to sell dark web scans courtesy of Experian, which is kind of funny considering Experian got owned. The super on the video says Rudy Giuliani, security expert, and there have been many lols this week.
Yes, they really have. It's so terrible. But yes, if you are worried about the dark web, then you too can go and give Experian your details, have them stolen and put on the dark web, which, you know, is kind of ironic in a way.
There you go. Mate, that's it for this week's news. Thank you very much for joining us. We weren't supposed to be speaking this week, and yet here we are because things changed.
And here we are.
But you're not on board next week, but we'll chat to you in 2 weeks, mate. Thanks a lot.
Yes, I'm away for work next week. And then, yes, I will return. I shall return. And we will talk again.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news. Big thanks to him for that. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Nick Steele and James Barclay of Duo Security. They are both senior security R&D engineers there. These two have been up to their ears in a new authentication specification called WebAuthN. It's essentially designed to glue together and expand on a lot of existing stuff. And once you hear what it's all about, you'll probably agree with me that having an open spec to do all of this crypto magic-backed multi-device authentication is really going to make life a lot easier for both users and enterprises. I've included some links in this week's show notes that Nick and James passed on to me. They've set up some sites where you can do sample WebAuthN enrollments and whatnot. Do check them out on the risky.biz website in the post for this week's show. But yeah, I got Nick and James on the line and started off by asking Nick Steele what WebAuthN actually is. And here's what he said.
Yeah, so WebAuthN is a emerging spec from the W3C. It's actually a group effort between the W3C and FIDO Alliance. It's kind of a next step to UAF, which was a spec made by the FIDO Alliance on their own, and then kind of in a push to get more browsers involved and more vendors in there. The WebAuthN spec was published by the W3C to handle web authentication on the internet, basically helping get rid of passwords by replacing them with strongly scoped and attested credentials that can be created on U2F tokens or through mobile devices, because most mobile devices now have a biometric attached to them. And basically, the spec scopes out how we can do that at the client level and the hardware level to a degree. But they also fall back on a new spec, which is CTAP, which is the client to authenticator protocol. But the WebAuthn spec now has just entered a candidate review. So Tim Berners-Lee and the rest of the W3C board has signed off on it. And it's made a big push forward. We see a lot of groups like Google, Mozilla with Firefox really leading the way, and Microsoft with Windows Edge, all involved and all making a push to get WebAuthn or passwordless credentials implemented in their respective browsers.
So when we say passwordless credentials, we've probably got to, you know, say what that actually means. I mean, are we talking just about some sort of second factor in a PIN, or like what does that look like?
Oh, James can take that.
Yeah. So in general, like what we're referring to here is a credential, like a public and private key that exists on some sort of a secure hardware. So like Nick mentioned, one way to do that would be, store the keys on a YubiKey or something like that. But one of the more interesting things about like WebAuthn, and something that sort of enabled WebAuthn, and will continue to enable it in the future, is the number of smartphones like that are being used, the ubiquity of smartphones, really. So like with security hardware built in. So like, for example, you would maybe go to a site, let's say, you know, whatever, facebook.com, and register with your phone or some other type of security key. A new public private key is minted for that site that is specific to that site. And then the next time you log in, you have that device on, you perform some type of ceremony to sort of authorize that.
I might go to my Gmail to log in, and it'll say, do a Face ID scan with your iPhone to progress.
Yeah. So
that might be like, I'm logging in through my desktop, but it's asking me to do this process through my mobile. Is it that sort of thing?
Correct. So that's the type of thing that Nick mentioned earlier. CTAP would that's the client to authenticator protocol. The CTAP 1 is currently available. CTAP 2 is the new protocol.
So is CTAP a part of WebAuthn? Is that right?
It's a separate spec, but it is something that WebAuthn is relying on to handle the communication between the user agent, like the browser, and the authenticator, which would be like maybe a U2F token or a phone with a trusted execution environment or a secure enclave or something like that, right?
Yeah. So it sounds like really what's happening is this is designed to, you tell me, is this designed to sort of supersede U2F or to incorporate it and build upon it? Like where does this stuff sit in the, you know, in the big picture, I guess?
Yeah. Yeah, so it definitely can take the place of U2F, and I wouldn't be surprised if within the next few years, you know, people will still be logging in with security keys, using them for second factor, but behind, you know, and using the same devices, but behind the scenes, it's actually using the WebAuthn API rather than U2F.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, so that sort of gets back to, you know, what we were talking about with user presence versus user verification. So like if I touch a YubiKey or another U2F token, or if I perform that ceremony, I am, you know, proving that someone was present. I can't prove that it was me. But if I tie that credential, the use of that credential to an individual such that like they need to either unlock it with their fingerprint or Face ID or something like that, or even a PIN, then we're able to glean like whether the user is who they say they are and they have that physical device.
It seems to me that, when we look at, first of all, it seems to me that this sounds like great news, and that this is the sort of thing that we've kind of been waiting for in a lot of ways. But it also strikes me that, you know, if you're dealing with something like an iPhone with an SEP, right, like this is going to work pretty well. But some of the other manufacturers of like phone handsets, for example, their implementations of this sort of trusted computing components don't seem to be as reliable. That said, this is always going to be a step forward, isn't it? Like even right. if the implementations of, you know, secure hardware on some like mobile platforms isn't 100%, like it's still just a good way to handle authentication and presence, because, you know, just by getting a couple of devices involved, you're really upping the complexity for the attackers.
Yeah, I think Nick could take that.
Yeah, one of the things that we're given with web authentication is attestation. That's our ability to prove that the authenticator that we're using, be it a phone, the TPM on your MacBook Pro, or your YubiKey, will provide attestation that they are, or that device is who they say they are within the authentication process. So when we get a response back, say we do log into, we're trying to log into Facebook.com, it will, when we do that registration flow, part of the registration response that we receive from the authenticator is this attestation object. And from there, we can say, oh, well, James was logging into Facebook and he was definitely using a MacBook Pro TPM to do it. And it will give us the certificate chain associated with the TPM on that MacBook. So we can say, you know, oh, this is a fairly reliable source of information.
Yeah. So it really is about upping that confidence. But it does sound to be replicating like the really important parts. Once we exclude things like second devices and, you know, SEPs on phones and stuff, it really does sound like it's just kind of replicating what U2F is doing already, right? And just sort of building on that.
It is building on that, and it's more specifically building on UAF. Now, UAF was the protocol that was spec'd out by FIDO Alliance themselves, and the UAF protocols is only worked from mobile devices. So similar specs within there would be, you know, logging in onto Chase's mobile banking app actually allows you to use a fingerprint, or some password managers allow you to use a fingerprint as well. That sort of space, it was UAF, and it only works on mobile devices. But what WebAuthn is expanding on is by, you know, allowing your desktop to get involved.
Yeah, okay. So it's sort of like gluing these things together.
Yeah, it's taking some of the best things of the old specs, UAF and U2F, and putting them on the browser.
This is James here. Behind the scenes, definitely WebAuthn and U2F look very similar, like in terms of like the crypto and everything, and the actual like verification process, like it's all very, very similar to U2F, which is good for, you know, developers that have already gone through the trouble of implementing U2F. It's not going to be a ton of work to implement WebAuthn, you know, if they've already done the work to add U2F support.
I have actually found myself wondering previously why we haven't had a standard that allows us to use the, you know, secure enclave processor on an iPhone, for example, to authenticate a desktop session. Like that has just seemed weird to me. And I know that we're building, you know, secure compute modules into laptops as well, but there's something about that crypto magic happening on a second device that just gives me the warm and fuzzies. Is that outdated thinking, or do you see where I'm coming from?
Definitely see where you're coming from. I think the spec as it stands, so there were more than a few authors from Google, and they have outlined a couple ways to handle the WebAuthn registration and assertion flows, which are the two steps. You register for an account, and then you assert your ownership of the account. So similar to, you know, registration and login. But Google has actually outlined in the spec how it should work through key attestation and SafetyNet, which are their current two forms of authentication directly to a device. I believe they already use it for some steps in authentication for Google products, mostly. But this will expand it to the greater browsers or other browsers.
Well, I know Google and Duo both are, you know, the true believers when it comes to, you know, BeyondCorp stuff. I mean, that's something we talk about on the show a fair bit. And, you know, this is a really important step to enable a bunch of that, isn't it?
Yeah. So this is James again. So yeah, I think definitely it is. So, you know, like one of the, you know, the tenets of the whole like BeyondCorp or zero trust networking architecture is like, you know, one of the important building blocks for that is strongly authenticating users. And I, you know, I think this is probably the most like rock solid way of like, of strongly authenticating users that, that we have, or we'll see in the next couple of years. So.
Now it sounds like both of you have been up to your armpits in this standard, you know, and really looking it over. And quite often when we see standards, you know, I'm thinking like OAuth 2, right? Like there was a big bun fight over OAuth 2 and people saying, "Oh, you're doing it wrong," and like this should be that way. Like, has there been much conflict around this one, or has it all been pretty smooth sailing and, you know, sensible contributions? Or are there sections that you look at and just go, "Whoa, that's going to be a problem later"?
I think that's something Nick could take.
Oh yeah, I got some feelings around this. The spec has been, I mean, it, at least conflict wise, fairly mild. I think it really just stems into at least more recently into variable names. Microsoft really likes their short variable names, while Google likes them fairly long and explicit.
Look, as far as arguments go, that's a pretty good one to be having, you know.
I was pretty amazed how even back in
they're arguing over which color to paint the feature wall, basically.
Basically, it's like if the argument is between saying, you know, exclude lists and exclusion options lists, that's fine. They can fight over that all day. Compared to the hard crypto, and a lot of the cryptography and the secure elements were already pretty well in place. Rolf Linderman of Knock Knock Labs has been involved since the beginning, and Rolf has worked on UAF and U2F. He's actually a big part, and I think a board member of the FIDO Alliance. He kind of put all his work forward, and everyone kind of ran from there. So they already had a pretty good base of work at the W3C for like what was already necessary and needed, and then from there, it's mostly just been, well, how does each, you know, browser want to implement it? And they've generally settled into two categories where Google and Mozilla are doing it, where it's the API, the web credential API, is accessible through navigator.credentials.get, and Microsoft was like, well, we wanted to integrate with Windows Hello still, so we're going to use, I think they're using navigation.credentials.get because that's what they've already defined. So it's really just a matter of syntax rather than, you know,
rather than the horror show that we've just seen with TLS 1.3, where people are like, "No, you're going to break things," and other people saying, "You want to backdoor it," and, you know, this is an outrage, and, you know, like fists now, flying, chairs being thrown around, committee meetings, that sort of thing.
Yeah, people humming very loudly in IETF meetings.
No, I know. Yeah, I read about that. That's crazy, right? Like,
rabble, rabble, rabble.
Rabble, rabble, rabble.
This has been a fairly mild spec that we've both been involved with, and there's been enough confidence in it that I think two months ago FIDO actually put together a workshop in San Francisco where they're like, "This is how it's going to work. This is a demo, and they did a workshop on how to implement it yourself. So there's enough confidence that things are going well that they're actually already educating people on how to implement it themselves.
And how much of a big deal is this going to be in terms of it becoming a W3C standard? Because they seem to be the ones that really get things moving.
I think it's going to be pretty big. It already is getting a lot of internal traction from what I can glean from Microsoft, from talking with Microsoft and Google, and Mozilla, as I mentioned, is really, really leading the way on the spec. JC Jones is the security lead at Mozilla, and I've worked with him since last September to actually put together Duo Labs, our group's working model of how WebAuthn would look in a production environment. It's been a big enough deal that people are planning internally how they're going to release it within their own companies.
Yeah.
This is James again. I would just say we do have a couple of places where you can go to like test out WebAuthn if you're interested in it or if you want to read more about it. So Nick put together a little demo site at webauthn.io where you can like register for an account using WebAuthn and then log in with it. Of course, at this point, you'll need something like a U2F security key. So if you've got a YubiKey and you want to test it out, feel free to check that out. And we also have some open source libraries and demonstration servers. So like I made those accessible some bit.ly links for them. One of them is a Golang WebAuthn server, and then we have a Python module.
All right. Well, all of those links are in this week's show notes. Gentlemen, Nick Steele, James Barclay, thank you very much for joining us to have a big chat about WebAuthn.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Nick Steele and James Barclay of Duo Security there. Big thanks to them for that. And in case you couldn't tell, Duo Security is a pretty big deal in the authentication space, particularly around multi-factor. So if you're looking at any type of MFA, you really should head on over to duo.com and have a look at their stuff. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.